Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. This episode is brought to you by our friends over at Be Dratty. We've been up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan playing a ton of golf this week, checking out a few different courses for the website and the podcast. While up here, I've been rocking a bunch of Be Dratty gear on and off the course. The Be Dratty polos are without a doubt the best out there. It's been pretty cool up here in the mornings, and sadly, it tells us that fall is coming. These shirts are absolutely perfect for those cooler fall temperatures. They're the absolute softest shirt I've ever felt, and it comes with this really cool, worn-in, old-school vibe. The style is actually modeled after JFK's, so it's a timeless, iconic feel. My current favorite is the Liam Polo. It's their original model. One might call it the OG of their product line. Actually, this morning, I wore one along with a ZR, zero restriction vest out at Gray Walls, and it was perfect for that high 50s morning, which is surely coming in the fall. So, you know, I got a little glimpse up in the Upper Peninsula of what's coming. It looked awesome, and if you want to check it out for yourself, go to www.bedratty.com to shop, or check out their Instagram, at bedratty. That's at bedratty. This episode, it's a little bit different. We're trying something new here. Let us know what you think about it. But Garrett Morrison, our managing editor at the Fried Egg, joined. We just kind of talked about our trip to Prairie Dunes and Southern Hills, where we OD'd on some Perry Maxwell. So we just talked about the differences and talked extensively about the recent renovation effort at Southern Hills, which is in line to host some major championships in the near future. So we talked at length about Gil Hance's renovation there at Southern Hills, and also our experience over at Prairie Dunes and the golf course and Perry Maxwell, and one of the more underappreciated architects in the world. So let us know what you think about this episode. I think we'll do more and more of these about specific courses and architects as we go along.
I miss a green, for example, I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
So Garrett, how's life in Portland?
Life in Portland is great. It's very chill up here. The golf is good, and we're really enjoying ourselves. Yeah, Oregon's awesome.
That's good. It's how do you find the golf scene there versus Pebble?
It's so much different, and in a lot of ways, it's so much better. 'Cause the golf scene in Monterey was all about those great courses that were sort of destination courses for people, super expensive to play. If you're a local, you weren't on them very often. And so golf was a very kind of formal thing on the Monterey Peninsula. You know, if you're a local, your options are kind of like Pacific Grove, Monterey Pines, Poppy Hills, sometimes the Black Horse Bayonet courses. And even those places, like, they're not the cheapest courses in the world. And if you go there, you can expect a longish round. And so that's kind of what golf was for me for a few years there. And now, now that I'm in this area, there are short courses, there are pitch and putts, there are golf courses that have like mini golf facilities attached to them. It's a lot different. Golf is, you know, there's more variety and it's a lot less formal here. So I'm really enjoying it. I know a few of the courses in the area already because my parents live up here, but my dad and I are going to try to play a different course every Friday morning. And so we'll kind of explore this scene that way. But last week we were at Eastmoreland, which is a municipal course in Portland. Pretty cool. And yeah, we'll go someplace different tomorrow morning.
Oh, that's exciting. It's a nice little tradition, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be a good way to kind of take advantage of the golf season, because the golf season does end here. Yeah. There's a point at which you it's no longer fun to play golf in Oregon. It gets a little bit too wet. So we're going to try to get it out of our systems before that happens.
So we took a trip a couple weeks ago to down, did a little Maxwell tour. This is your first exposure to Perry Maxwell. I'd seen some stuff. I'd been to Prairie Dunes. So we went to Prairie Dunes and Southern Hills, and figured we'd reconvene here and talk a little bit about Perry Maxwell and the two courses we saw. Obviously, Prairie Dunes, iconic place that, you know, most people have heard about, and Southern Hills, a, you know, championship course, but had just underwent a Gil Hance restoration and renovation. I'm not sure what you would call it, you know, retrovation.
Restovation is sometimes the term people use, but he said 20 to 25% renovation and 75 to 80% restoration. That's the number he put on it.
So what did you know about Perry Maxwell, I called him Prairie Maxwell, Perry Maxwell coming into the trip, and what kind of were your key takeaways from the architect that, you know, most people don't know a ton about?
Yeah, I knew embarrassingly little about Perry Maxwell going into this trip. I guess I knew that he had designed Prairie Dunes, and I was really excited about playing that course. I've been looking forward to playing that course for many years now. But aside from that, I suppose I primarily knew him as an Alistair McKenzie associate, somebody who helped build a few of McKenzie's courses, including Crystal Downs. And so that's primarily where I heard his name. I was aware that there were some great courses that he built in Oklahoma and in that general region. But aside from that, just didn't know much about him. I guess I had heard the term Maxwell Rolls before, right? Which refers to the characteristics of his greens, his kind of rolling greens. But, you know, at the same time, there are a lot of architects who are known for bold green contours. And so it didn't really stick in my mind as being something distinctive to Maxwell. So that's kind of what I knew before. What about you? Like, so you had played Prairie Dunes before. I mean, what was your appreciation of Maxwell like?
And I'd seen Crystal Downs too, which he had, right. You know, he was pretty, you know, he was obviously McKenzie's associate there and had a, you know, large role in that golf course. And, you know, I think one of the things I take away from Perry Maxwell, and I think like Langford Moreau fall into this bucket too, is that we romanticize the golden age architects, and the ones that get the most love tend to be the ones that designed in the most high profile places and have had their designs the best preserved, right? Where like Alistair McKenzie is obviously one of the greatest architects of all time, but he also has the, you know, he has like museum pieces that have been well preserved in very high, like Cypress Point is a perfect example of that, where it's on Monterey Peninsula, like it's got huge exposure and it's perfectly preserved, right? And I think like, you know, the same thing could be said about like the Rainer McDonald's out east, where they're in these high profile areas and they haven't been that messed up. And I think Maxwell and Langford Moreau are two architects where their designs are in lesser known places, lots of small towns, lots of rural areas. And they also were building golf courses at the very end of the golden age and had their careers kind of derailed. And a lot of their work, for many reasons, because of where they built it, hasn't been preserved the way, you know, National Golf Links or Piping Rock or these types of golf courses have out east, or Tillinghast work in New York. So I think Perry Maxwell, you know, arguably is maybe the most underrated or underappreciated architect in the country of the U.S. architects.
Yeah, he might very well be. And I think also part of it is, and you alluded to this by saying that Langford and Moreau and Perry Maxwell both built a lot of courses in rural areas, in small towns. Perry Maxwell built most of his courses in the same region, in Oklahoma. I'm not exactly sure how many courses he built in Oklahoma alone, but it was a lot. And so to a great extent, he was a regional architect. You know, that's not to say that he didn't go elsewhere. Obviously, he built Old Town. He worked on Augusta National. He did some traveling, especially after he had gotten established as an architect. But the concentration of his work was in Oklahoma, in the area where he lived. And I think that regional architects do tend to be underappreciated compared to these globe-trotting architects like Alistair McKenzie, or compared to architects who built near huge urban areas.
Yeah, like George
McDonald
Thomas would
and
be.
Rainer and Thomas, yeah. Exactly.
Like, because Thomas, you could say, was like a regional architect in a way, you know?
Right.
And but he was building it in LA and, you know, built these famous championship courses.
And I think the same could be said of today's architects, right? We have a set of globe-trotting international architects who often will get to work on some of those courses near big urban centers. And then we also have these architects who are focusing their work in one region. Dan Hickson in Oregon, the Colligan design firm, Trey Kemp in Texas. You know, and there's a lot of good work going on in these concentrated regional places, but obviously a lot of the attention tends to go to the architects who are traveling the world, like Tom Doak or Gil Hance or David McClay Kidd.
Yeah, yeah, you bring up, and then there's also these guys that now, with the way architecture is today, is like, they have to specialize in a certain thing. So like, you know, Chris Spence with Ross Restorations, or Jeff Mingay has been doing tons of AV McCann work in Pacific Northwest. Like
he's very much, yeah, he's kind of on this regional model, isn't he? He's a lot of his work is in Washington and I guess British Columbia.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I think seeing two, you know, now very well preserved Maxwell courses, you know, with the original nine. So Perry Maxwell did our original nine at Prairie Dunes, for those that don't know. And it's widely considered kind of the last design of the Golden Age. You know, you could argue many, but, you know, it's considered, you know, kind of like the last great design of the Golden Age. And you know, and then his son Press came in and did a subsequent nine that's apparently to the plans that Perry had laid out when he designed Prairie Dunes in the late 30s. So he did this in the height of the Depression in Hutchinson, Kansas, on, you know, the sandy site, and did it with pretty much no money, which is one of the amazing things, I think, with Maxwell, is how many courses he designed during the Great Depression.
Yeah, yeah, it's remarkable. And he designed his best-known courses in 1935, 1936, 1937, right? And that was a really hard time to get anything built in America, much less golf courses. But there were some, I mean, we can get into this further later maybe, but there were some unique circumstances about where he was and who he was that enabled him to do this. You know, he was, first of all, an independently wealthy person. He didn't really go broke like other Golden Age architects did. And so in some senses, he was an exception and took advantage of circumstances in his area. Nonetheless, he built these courses for very little money, even at the time.
Yeah, you've read Maxwell's book. I've read some of it, the Midwest Associate,
Chris Clouser.
Yeah, Chris Clouser. And I was curious, can you give us a little background on Perry Maxwell?
Sure, absolutely. So I'm definitely not a Perry Maxwell expert. I've just read this book by Chris Clouser called The Midwest Associate. Also read a couple of kind of specific things about the Southern Hills and Prairie Dunes club histories. But from what I was able to gather from Chris Clouser's book, Perry Maxwell grew up in Kentucky in a wealthy family. Eventually relocated when he was making a family of his own to Ardmore, Oklahoma, where he worked as a banker for many years. And he was a very well-respected and well-known local person. People all over the region, in fact, knew who he was and really respected him as a banker and a significant member of the community. While he was still working at the bank in Ardmore, and this happened to be actually a very wealthy little pocket in Oklahoma at the time because of the oil money. So there was a lot of money running through there. There were a lot of kind of newly rich people, and he was part of that cash flow, I guess you could say. Perry Maxwell got interested in golf architecture, and his first course he actually built on his own land. So that was Dornick Hills, and it's right there in Ardmore on the Perry Maxwell estate. And that's where he kind of worked out his initial theories and methods of golf architecture. It looks like it used to be one heck of a golf course. I mean, just fascinating. There are still sketches of what the holes look like. It still exists there, but I think in very much altered form. And so that's how he got his start. And, you know, from there, throughout the 1920s, he was building courses in Oklahoma and the surrounding areas, some courses in really remote places and some really rough places, a few sand green courses. And he just eventually developed a great reputation as a golf architect. Eventually, Alistair McKenzie heard about him and used him on a couple of projects, including, as you mentioned earlier, Crystal Downs. And then when the Depression hit, Perry Maxwell was one of the few golf course architects who was still really producing significant work. So in 1935, he built Southern Hills in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That opened in 1936. And then right after that, he built the original nine at Prairie Dunes. And those are probably his two best known original designs now. In any case, he's a remarkable person. There's a lot more to his life story. But a couple of the ways in which he's distinct from other architects of the Golden Age, first of all, you know, there were no other, you know, architects that we know of now who were in his region or anywhere close. And so it's just, there's this genius golf architect who came out of Oklahoma.
He visited Scotland too, you know,
yes, that's right. In 1920, I believe.
Yeah. So like that, I think that's something that where you see so many of the great Golden Age architects learned from Scotland. And I remember reading, he got interested because of National Golf Links, and he went and talked to C.B. McDonald and then went to Scotland. And that kind of, it's amazing how many, you know, how the architects that built golf courses in America that went to Scotland and those that did, like, I, you know, it's just a really fascinating dichotomy. And it's like, you know, seemingly the most prolific ones came either from the UK or went on a pilgrimage to Scotland.
The pilgrimage was part of the education, right? Yeah. It was almost a necessary step. And I think Perry Maxwell really took the lessons that he learned in Scotland to heart. You know, whenever he spoke about golf course architecture, he wasn't as prolific in his kind of public speaking about or writing about golf course architecture as Alistair McKenzie or C.B. McDonald were. But whenever he did speak about golf architecture, he talked about learning from Scottish courses that nature was more interesting than anything that man could create. There's in particular this interview that appeared in the magazine American Golfer in, I think, 1935. And it's just, you know, quote after quote in this interview is just fantastic. So he says things like, "It is my theory that nature must precede the architect in the laying out of links. It is futile to attempt the transformation of wholly inadequate acres into an adequate course. Invariably, the result is the inauguration of an earthquake. The site of a golf course should be there, not brought there." Later on, he says, "The less of man's handiwork, the better a course." He was really a fanatic about naturalness, and I think that he probably, that conviction of his was confirmed by going to Scotland and seeing how those courses were laid out on the land.
Yeah, I think obviously you see a lot of the way he uses the land at Prairie Dunes. I mean, he did it with his tiny budget. It's one of the amazing stories is that he did it with essentially an ox and a cart. He built this golf course, and the only way you build a golf course that way is by using the natural terrain. And I think one of the things, you know, there's the blindness, and he was kind of the last of the artists that before we entered this new era of golf architecture where the designs became kind of built versus found. And it's an interesting thing. I think one of the parts of his legacy that just and this is everybody favoring to talk about Alistair Mackenzie, but Maxwell was so vital in the development and what today is Augusta National. I mean, for example, the 10th hole got, is pretty much entirely Maxwell. He moved the green, yes, 90 yards. That's why there's that Mackenzie bunker sitting there in the middle of the fairway. And also made a ton of modifications on the greens while also being extremely involved in the building of Augusta National. I mean, he was partnered up with Mackenzie to do that project. Mackenzie worked with Robert Hunter on the West Coast, and pretty much everywhere else he worked with Perry Maxwell.
Yes, right. If you go through that great article that appeared in Golf Digest a couple of years back, the complete changes to Augusta National, and you just go through hole by hole and look at what Perry Maxwell did there, you begin to understand that to a significant degree, that course is the result of a kind of cross-generational collaboration between a number of architects, but very high among those is Perry Maxwell. And especially when you see that 10th green, that is a Maxwell green. There are some other Maxwell greens on that course as well. And people often forget that.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about Prairie Dunes. What were your impressions of Prairie Dunes? We spent a couple days there, played how many holes? 54 holes about? 45,
45, I think, yeah. because that one evening we played nine.
Yeah, it was a very, very hot. It was, end of June. So it was like 100 degrees every day. I'm curious as somebody that hadn't been there, what would you expect and what did you come away thinking?
So I was very excited about playing Prairie Dunes. I had been looking at pictures of that course and maps of that course since I was a golf architecture nut as a kid. And I had always thought of it as one of the courses that I really wanted to play. It just looked cool. And so I was really excited about it. My expectations were very high. And they were, completely met by my experience at the course. I don't see how they couldn't be. Once you drive into that region of land, right, you're sort of,
So it's about 50 minutes from Wichita. It's in Hutchinson.
Flew into Wichita,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's Hutchinson, Kansas. So, the last spot in America that you'd expect a great golf course, maybe not the last one of the last.
You just don't expect that land to all of a sudden appear out of the prairie, right? You're going around, you fly into Wichita and you're kind of driving around there and it's perfectly lovely and everything, but you just don't see it yet. But then, about 30 miles, 20, 30 miles away from Prairie Dunes, you start to see the land rumble a little bit. And you start to see these sand dunes and these kind of exposed sandy blowouts. And there you are in the middle of the country, and you see this kind of ocean-shaped stuff. And so that's the first thing that strikes you, is just how completely ideal the land is. And when you drive into Prairie Dunes, you know, the first thing you see is not necessarily the golf course. You don't necessarily notice that, hey, there's the golf course. It's more like you see this incredible land, these huge sand dunes, these really interesting landforms. And then you start to notice, okay, there are some fairways and greens that are draped across these landforms. You know, that was my first impression, just driving down that driveway and seeing the incredible undulation of that piece of property. And it's a really unique looking place, because while it's sand dunes, right? And so it's familiar in the sense that you've seen these kinds of undulations on Lynx courses before, but the flora, the trees and the grasses is very much prairie stuff. And so it's a perfectly named golf course, right? It's Prairie Dunes. It's not your, you know, I don't know if there's a typical sand dune, but it's not your typical kind of seaside sand dune look.
Yeah,
there's
like you'd see in Monterey. Hybrid. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you or you'd see in Bandon or something. It is its own completely unique ecosystem there. I've never seen anything quite like it. These cottonwood trees and the gunch and, you know, all this stuff. It just looks, it's not just pure seaside stuff. It's something different. It's a hybrid of landscapes. And it's really, really striking and really beautiful. And obviously Perry Maxwell was smart enough in building the original mine and, you know, to his credit, Press Maxwell, allowed this to happen too, that they didn't violate these, this terrain. They just kind of put the golf course on top of it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the neat thing. And I mean, you see it with Golden Age architecture so much is where, you know, with the lack of earth moving equipment, they had no choice but to use the land. And then you can tell with Prairie Dunes, like the effort was so focused on the green complexes where they were going to, you know, generate interest at the green and through the land, the natural topography. You see those micro contours of where, you know, you're rarely hitting from even lies at Prairie Dunes, you know, a lot of side hill lies, uphill, downhills. If you're, you know, especially on, you know, some select holes where, you know, eighth and ninth holes, you know, have this unbelievable, you know, kind of rolling small, like 8-foot contours to them, which create, you know, all types of different lies. And you just, you know, you hit it and you pray that you get a good one, versus, and it's much more, you know, it's a very Lynx feel. I would say it's an American Lynx golf course, without a doubt. And the greens, and I think, like, you know, I had always heard Maxwell rolls, and until I really had been to Prairie Dunes, I didn't really understand what that was. But the way he built these rolls is so much different and more unique than the shelves you see at, you know, like your traditional, say, course that down the street, where you'll have like a, you know, an undulation going up and then it's a flat tier, right? The way Maxwell built them was there, you're sloping up and then it hits the peak and then there's a slope on the back. So the what makes these greens so unique is when you're on the wrong side of a Maxwell roll, you have to hit a putt up over a hill and then it's going to run back down a hill and away. So it just requires so much more of a deft touch to navigate than your kind of uphill flat putt that you see at so many golf courses.
Absolutely. And when you are on the greens, you're not thinking to yourself very often, oh, this is an absolutely crazy green, or, you know, what an insane green this is. There's a subtlety to them, but the movement is constant on them. Every part of those greens is moving in some way or another. And you start kind of reaching for these metaphors. Are they like potato chips? Are they scalloped? Are they, you know, like, there's just kind of a wonderful unity to all those green complexes. And they're just a lot of fun to play around, because each of them, you haven't really seen them before. You know how you, most greens you go to, you can kind of compare them to something else. Each of those greens, especially on the original nine at Prairie Dunes, is pretty unique, and really fun to play.
It's interesting, yeah. Comparing, because, you know, at Prairie Dunes, so the second nine was built by Press, and, you know, they're kind of mixed in between. So you play, you know, 1, 2, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 17, 18 is the original nine, but all the other holes are Press's nine. And I think, like, what you see is that you see there's a distinct difference in the greens, and the Press holes are exceptional golf holes, but you can see that the difference in the Press Maxwell greens, and like, and you can just see the difference, you know, really, like, I, you know, you don't want, but like the skill of Perry versus Press is so evident in those greens, because when you're 20 feet away on a Press green, you're going to have a very makeable putt, but on a Perry green 20 feet away, you're going to have to hit an unbelievable putt to make it.
Yes, the Press greens are just a little bit less complex. Now, there are exceptions to this, right? The third green, which is a Press Maxwell green, is pretty cool, you know, and has some of those characteristics that the Perry greens have. But in general, they aren't quite as bold. But, you know, whenever you compare the Perry and the Press holes, which is something that is, you know, you can't resist doing it, you always have to keep in mind, I think, that the Press holes, as you, and you alluded to this, are still really, really, really good. It's just that original nine is just about the greatest golf course that I've ever played. You know, that original nine hole course, every single hole is absolutely brilliant. And so you can't help but make the comparison. But I was wondering, so what are some of your favorite holes at the, on the course, whether they're Perry holes or Press holes? What are some ones that you would want to highlight?
I think like the sixth hole is maybe my favorite hole on the golf course. And obviously I think, like, I'd have to say, like, you know, one of the things, it's a terrific course. Like, one of the things that's crazy about Prairie Dunes is it's one of my favorite courses and that I've played. And the simple fact is that, you know, it might be the best course that I've ever played that still can get like 20-30% better just with presentation. Because like the six is a perfect example where like the mow lines are just, it seems like since when they hosted the U.S. Senior Open that they never seem to get their mow lines back out. And just by widening out the fairway, they'd restore so many of the features that are there. And the six is a perfect example where, you know, the fairway has, you know, essentially shrunk to where, you know, what used to be a central bunker is now in the left rough. And, you know, then there's another bunker that's, you know, 20 yards in the right rough. You know, the rough out there isn't crazy thick. The gunch is horrible stuff, but I think the six is really neat. It's one of the neatest drive and, you know, drive wedge par fours that I've played, with just the green and, I mean, anything. And then obviously the eighth hole is tremendous. I mean, the terrain, we talked about that a little bit, and it's a long par four with, I think one of the things out at Prairie Dunes is the amazing thing is you always get wind out there. We played it on like very calm days, but even, you know, one of the days having like a 8 mile an hour wind out there is much stronger than your typical 8 mile an hour wind. And I've played it on days where it's blowing 25 and it's like, you're just praying for dear life. And, I think that's one of the unique things with what Maxwell did was he was, you know, afforded the great land, he built great greens, and then the wind takes care of it. Like when the wind blows out there, it's as hard of a golf course as you could possibly play.
Yes, especially with the gunch the way it is, and maybe we could talk about that more later, but the high grass beyond what's maintained regularly at Prairie Dunes is stuff where you're often not going to find your ball And if you do find your ball, you're probably not going to be playing it out of it.
Yeah.
And so if the wind blows and you're not completely in control of your golf ball, you're going to lose a few out there. And the course gets really hard really quickly. And I think the course, even without a lot of wind, is very, very difficult for somebody who is struggling to hit it straight off the tee. Like, it's just going to be a non-starter from the beginning. I know, for especially the first couple of rounds there, I didn't have great control over my golf ball, and things just start moving very, very, very quickly.
Yeah, obviously the Gunch is something they work so hard on fixing there. And it's one of the native areas are some of the toughest things to maintain. And it's so much better than the last time I was there. But I'd love to see that return. Like, you can see with some old photos, they have like this like kind of chunk sandy with like native in it, and they're more exposed sand. And that'd be cool to see with the sand dunes, getting a little bit more exposed, and thinning that stuff out. But it's just an amazing place. And I think, you know, that it kind of sets the tone well for, you know, understanding Maxwell. You get a really good feel there. And then I was actually, the course that really kind of blew me away was Southern Hills. I had never been, but I'd, you know, watched the PGA and the, you know, US Open there, or back in the day, when Tiger won, and then the one that Goosen won. And showing on TV the way it did with the bunkers and the trees, it did not look like an interesting course. And getting out there, I was like, that's kind of where a light bulb went on for me with Maxwell and how good he was. Now for a quick word from our sponsor. Today's episode is powered by TD Ameritrade. Whether on the course or in the market, it helps to have a second set of eyes to keep you on your game. That's why TD Ameritrade's trade desk is here to help gut check your strategies so you always feel confident teeing up a trade. Visit tdameritrade.com/friedegg to learn more about what their trade desk can do for you. Member SIPC. Now back to our talk about Southern Hills and Prairie Dunes.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah, and Prairie Dunes, you expect to be great. You know, it could hardly help being great with that land. Obviously, the Maxwells used the land brilliantly and turned that into an unbelievable golf course. But when you go to Southern Hills, it's a great piece of land, but it's not obviously as sublime as the sand dunes up in Kansas. And so walking around that course and seeing how it's put together really brings Maxwell's brilliance into relief, I think. All right, so what were your first impressions of Southern Hills? Now, we got there in the evening, and we kind of walked with the superintendent down onto the grounds. What were some of your first impressions as we went in there? Because it really does make a first impression.
Yeah, TV is historic. You know, everybody talks about it. It flattens everything, and I couldn't believe how bland and generic TV, and I guess kind of the way the golf course was presented then had made it look, because you walked out there and like you're standing on the first tee, which, you know, the clubhouse sits on this high hill, and then everything kind of unfolds from there. The first tee and the 10th tee go from this high hill, and the front nine goes out and kind of spirals around and comes back up the hill. And then the back nine goes off the hill and spirals around and comes back up the hill. And I think like the thing that your first impression is like, holy cow, this is like a grand property. Like that seems to be the word that I always get fixated on when I'm describing Southern Hills, is it's just like a grand place. Like it is a true championship course. It's got space. It's big and it's brawny, and the land in a way reminded me in parts of Augusta National, because it's got this, they have this creek that runs through the property, and everything around that creek, it's got this really nice movement to it, and these big broad slopes that, you know, bank, you know, fairways off of, just like you'd see at Augusta with like the 13th, the the 12th at Southern Hills really reminds me of that, where it's banking hard on right to left, just kind of like the 13th at Augusta. And I was blown away with the property, and I think that it's a course I can't wait to see, you know, major championship golf played at it again.
Yeah, you just want to see a crowd on that course. And it's going to be a really, really fun place to go see a big championship, I think, because, and it probably was, you know, in the 2001 US Open and the 2007 PGA Championship, but even more now after the restoration, because you can see across that property so well now. I mean, there are still trees, but there are gaps between them. And when you walk down into the valley from the hill where the clubhouse sits, you can just see in every direction. You can see to the edges of the course. And it's just a playground out there. And a lot like Augusta, you know, there are these huge scale slopes and everything generally moves away from the clubhouse and it's bigger than it looks on TV. So those are some similarities with Augusta. But the underrated thing is that the routing creates these little areas of activity. Augusta does that as well. And so if you're watching a golf tournament there, you can camp out in certain places on that course and see action on multiple different greens at once. If you go down by the first green, you'll be able to see what's going on, obviously, on the second tee, but also on the third green and the fourth tee and the eighth green, the ninth tee and the 17th green. And the seventh green is just across the second hole there. That's just a hub of activity. And even without anybody there, it's an exciting place to be. You just feel like golf is happening around you. And then there are these great kind of greens all clustered around each other. And I think that the course creates excitement in that way. It creates a concentration of energy. And so for that reason, it's just going to be a really, really fun place to see a golf tournament. And I think if it's covered correctly, I think it is shot correctly on TV, that will really be brought out, because now you can see across the property a little bit better.
What do you think of Gil's work there in terms of there were a couple things that he changed to modify for championship golf. You wrote a great article kind of going in depth about the whole renovation restoration done there. And I'm curious, so there were a couple modernizations or some new tees. It's not like put fully back, but you know, this is a golf course that wants to host major championship golf.
Right. Yeah, that was the theme of my article that I eventually settled on, was how Gil Hance, on the one hand, obviously is committed to restoring golf courses. Right, he's inspired by golden age golf architecture. Southern Hills is certainly an instance of golden age architecture. And so I don't think he would have gone there and not tried to restore as much as possible. And he did, in a couple of ways that we can talk about. But at the same time, he was very aware that Southern Hills wants to host major championships in the future. The PGA Championship is going to go to Southern Hills sometime in the next decade, probably 2030, maybe 2025.
Hopefully sooner than later.
Like Yeah, 2030 seems like a long way away. But there are some other championships that are going to be held there in the meantime. I believe is it the Senior Open that's coming up fairly soon?
Yep.
But in any case, In doing his work there, he was obviously aware that he couldn't completely put the course back to its 1936 form, because if he did that, then it wouldn't really be a 21st century championship golf course. So there would have to be certain changes he'd have to make. And it was beyond just establishing some of those back tees. Now, that shouldn't be underrated. Obviously, when you put a tee back from the original ones, you have to kind of put it on the right angles, and there's a whole art to that. But there were other things that he did there to accommodate future championships, one of which was to, you know, probably the most noticeable change on any given hole was at the seventh hole. which had already been changed, right? Maxwell's original hole at the seventh hole was a dog leg, a fairly short dog leg par four that veered up a hill to the left with a green that's right on a boundary. Later on, by the 1960s, the club had moved that green back down the hill, making the hole more or less straight away. It no longer veered left. It kind of ended at this green that was in the middle of what used to be the kind of crook of the dog leg going up, and turned it into sort of a somewhat featureless hole, I guess. The drive was still pretty cool because you're kind of trying to carve something into that big left to right slope.
And it was kind of like semi-blind, which Maxwell liked blind tee shots is one thing definitely have picked up on.
That's one, I think it's probably one way in which he opened up sight lines going into greens, right? Because he didn't move much land. And so if you're going to have any places where there are blind shots, it's going to be on a drive. Because generally his sight lines are pretty open going into greens, right?
Yeah, really open. I can't think of any blind greens.
I don't think, from what I can gather, it doesn't seem like he really believed in blind or even very much semi-blind approaches. There are some greens that putting surfaces that are concealed.
Well, if you're on the wrong side and like you wonder where, like I always wonder where like the first fairway of Prairie Dunes should be, you know, because if you went up the left there, you could be blind over that dune.
Mm-hmm. That's one of those mowing lines from
the senior
tournament that has been, it's really obvious when you go there and look at it. It's just this straight mowing line going right up the middle of what should be the fairway.
You're
right. It's so he used concealed or open sight lines to reward precise tee shots and stuff like that. But in general, you know, his routings are really clever, right? He took the land, he didn't move much of it, but he made the routing work. In any case, that hole at Southern Hills had been changed. It was now a 380-yard par four. There wasn't a whole lot of difficulty there, right? Most modern pros were able to hit a hybrid and then still have a short iron into the green. And so Gil, instead of restoring Maxwell's hole, decided to push the green back and put it up against the creek on the right. And what he created there is a really interesting strategic par four, and it can stretch to about 440 yards. It'll be a challenging hole. That approach is not comfortable, and there are some angles in play there. And it's a very, very good and interesting hole and a tough hole, but it's not a Maxwell restoration. That is a Gil Hance hole at this point. And I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with that. But if you're a pure restorationist, if you're a hardliner about golden age architecture and about the necessity for bringing it back, then that hole might be a site of objection.
Yeah, I think that hole is really compelling just because of the way the land moves. And you know, you're hitting a drive, and the further left you go, which is, you know, a little bit more aggressive, there's trees. You get a flatter lie. You get rewarded with a flatter lie and a more approach. The way the angle of the green is, if you're over on the right, you've got this left to right lie, a ball below your feet, which, you know, promotes that right miss, and the creek is pushed right up against the right edge of the green from there. So like your miss is right into that creek. And that's a hole where you have to just commit and hit a really good shot into that green, which I think is really good for championship golf. And it's going to be a hard hole for members regardless, but like a member who's, you know, you can just hit it up there short and chip on and putt. Like it's one of those Jeff Ogilvy always talks about, like, you know, hard to make birdie, you know, easy par bogey holes, like at Augusta. And that's like a quintessential hole, I feel like, at Augusta, where if you want to make a birdie, you really have to hit a great shot. And it wouldn't be that hard to hit into the middle of the green and two putt to and make par for a pro. You know, granted, you made birdie. You know,
I had an unusual hole there. That was an uncharacteristically well played hole on my part. But yeah, I mean, it's playable. I hit a good drive, and that was really what set me up. Right, I had a much easier approach than you did. In any case, that's one sort of big change, but I think we both agree that we like that hole. I mean, it's a cool golf hole. I'm not sure what the old one would look like now, but, certainly what Gil Hance contends is that having that green that near the boundary now wouldn't really be workable, especially because, you know, the urban Tulsa has grown up around the course since it was built out in the country, you know, back in 1935. And now it is surrounded by dense development. And so you can't really have greens as hard against the boundaries. And he did move a couple of other greens away from boundaries, or at least one other, the par 3 14th hole. And so those are some of the accommodations you have to make for what happens.
I think one of the things it does is it gives it a better cadence on the front nine, like, because the way the front nine flows and it adds a little variety, actually. If you know, if they restored it back, it would, you know, the fourth hole, the fifth hole. So there's a par three, long par 3-6 before. Then the fifth hole is a par 5, and the fourth hole is a short par 4, and the third hole is a medium length par 4. Nothing, you know, it'll be a short par four
For the pros. Yeah, I think they'll be hitting short irons into that green for sure.
So having a medium to longer par 4 in that spot fits well, because the ninth hole is a short par 4, all like a shortish par 4, and the tenth hole isn't a very long hole either. So, like, having that in there, it gives it a little bit more variety. So I really like that change, to be honest.
I agree. And I think it's going to be a fun hole to watch. It's a nervy shot, you know, and you'll be able to see on TV where they are in the fairway and what kind of lie they're facing. Yeah, I think it'll be cool. If they were playing the old hole, it would be a pitch up the hill. And no doubt it would be cool, but a completely, completely different kind of golf hole. So another big change that was made, and another thing that I kind of focused on in the article, was the first hole, which is a longish, more medium length par 4, going down from the clubhouse, spectacular tee site right in front of the clubhouse, basically directly outside the clubhouse door. And it goes down the hole and moves to the left along with the kind of right to left sloping land to a really cool green that has edges that kick away. And the green generally sort of moves away from the line of play.
And it opens from the left side, that green.
It opens from the left side, yes. Yeah,
so, you know, being on that left side is a big advantage.
And that was the strategic principle that Gil Hance had in mind when he moved the bunkers on that hole. So that hole used to have bunkers on the outside of the dogleg on the right. Robert Trent Jones put those bunkers in the run-up to the 1958 U.S. Open. He added bunkers in various parts of the course. Not many bunkers, but he did add some fairway bunkers and a few greenside bunkers. Those were among the bunkers he added. He put them on the outside of the dogleg on the right. And as you alluded to, you don't want to be on the right on that hole, because that becomes a really hard approach where the green is running away from you. You're hitting over a bunker and you're also hitting toward a back bunker. You're directly in line with those two bunkers, and it's hard to hold the green from there, really. You also have the ball above your feet up there. And it's just not the kind of shot that you want. You don't want to be hitting a hard draw for a right-hander down that green right at those bunkers. So you want to be on the left side. And that left side of the fairway just had trees on it. It was that was its defense. It has been widened. Trees have been removed along that hole. And in doing the renovations, Gil Hance could have just taken the bunkers out if he wanted to do a pure restoration. But he decided to put the bunkers on the left side. Now the bunkers are exactly where you want to be on that hole. And so they serve a kind of classic strategic purpose, but it is not a pure restoration. Nonetheless, I can't argue with that change. You know, it's a really, really good golf hole. And those bunkers are, you know, if you're going to put fairway bunkers on that hole, that's exactly the right place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, in the short grass, that's, you know, I talked to Jeff Ogilvy a little bit, you know, off the kind of before, I think it was after we finished recording our last podcast, and I asked him about it, and he was like, you know, just the presentation, like if they just had more short grass there, it would have been so awesome in 07. He's like, it's a great, great golf course. And it's like, now they have the short grass, and it's so refreshing to see, because, you know, these greens, it just accentuates these Maxwell greens. And we talked about Maxwell greens and the roles with Prairie Dunes at Southern Hills. You just see all the greens fall off, you know, in all these directions. And then it's just short grass that further repels them away. And that's going to be a really compelling thing to watch when the senior PGAs that are in 2021 and when they have the PGA, is that we've seen this recipe work so well for championship golf, is short grass with great land and topography. You know, you think about your Shinnecock Hills where you've got short grass, lots of fairway, but then short grass around greens with repelling edges, which is what you see at Southern Hills. And then you think like Augusta National, you got short grass everywhere and a really great set of greens, many of which are Maxwell greens. And I think that's where what gets me most excited about Southern Hills is that you're going to see a championship course that has shares many of the characteristics of our favorite championship golf courses that we get to see. And, you know, to a certain extent, Port Rush was that way a couple weeks ago for the Open Championship as well, where you had repelling green edges and really nice topography that yielded a lot of uneven lies.
Repelling green edges and sometimes collecting green edges, right? If you're coming in from the right angle, sometimes that short grass can help funnel your ball to where you want it to go. And that's part of what we saw at Port Rush as well. That was so fun to watch. But it should be said that Hants focused on restoring the edges of the greens at Southern Hills. A lot of the interior contours of the greens had previously been put back, so Hants was able to kind of focus on the edges, and a lot of work had been done on those edges. And generally, what you see are contours that kick away. And the kicking away effect is enhanced by the amount of short grass that is around the greens now. And there are these expanses of short grass. You look at that first green, everything in every direction is short grass. And so that's going to be extremely uncomfortable, because if you miss, your ball is going to kick away and it's going to keep rolling. And we've seen that be a very uncomfortable proposition for good players. It's going to be a really, really fun one to watch. I guess the big question here, and you know, I didn't really dive into this too deeply in the article because maybe I don't really know the answer, but do you think that Southern Hills would be a better golf course if there were not the imperative to prepare it for championship golf? If it didn't want to host major championships, if there weren't that pressure on it, And that wasn't part of the thought process in restoring/renovating it, do you think it would be better?
That's an interesting question. I think the seventh hole is really good, and that's like one of the things. And I think the first hole, like you alluded to, it makes way more sense with those bunkers on the left. Like if it was bunkerless, it would be more playable. I guess the question would be like, do you think there'd be even more short grass and more trees removed if it had no qualms about hosting major championship golf?
Maybe there'd be more trees removed.
Yeah.
I mean, the tree removal is not radical there. There's definitely been tree removal. There's
a lot,
definitely
yeah.
been enough, like a lot of tree removal, because that place used to be very heavily treed. There are still trees in play on the hole. That's part of the penalty for missing the fairway. And there's a significant amount of rough. The fairways aren't endlessly wide. Mm-hmm. I don't know if these things would necessarily make the golf course better, but if there weren't the pressure to host championships, yeah, maybe it would be different.
Something that gets me with this discussion, it's so such an interesting discussion. And when you think about golf courses, like, one of the things that stood out to me with Southern Hills is usually when I go to play a championship golf course, like I know I'm in for like a day of just getting beat up, you know, like I had like a lot of fun at Southern Hills where like it's just because of the expanded short grass and there's enough width out there that I didn't feel like it was as exacting. It was still extraordinarily difficult, but like it wasn't that not fun difficult where you're like, okay, I have to hit this drive absolutely perfect. And you felt like you had opportunities to get the course. And, you know, take this with a grain. But, like, it was actually, like, the champion, like, in terms, if you put championship golf courses in a bucket, it was as fun as I've had anywhere. Like, up with, like, Shinnecock's one, another example of this, where Shinnecock is so hard, but you feel like you can score out there. Like, you know, nothing is unfair. Nothing, like, it's not overly hard, but it's just really hard, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah, I think it depends on where the difficulty comes from. Right now, the difficulty at Southern Hills is going to come significantly around the greens, right? And around the awkwardness of some of the approaches, the way that the slopes and the undulations work to give you some stances that just aren't going to be what you want them to be. They're not what you're going to see on driving ranges and into greens that are kind of oriented against or away from those lies. That's where the challenge really comes from. And that is kind of a fun sort of challenge. Like, personally, I don't mind getting beat up around the greens. I don't mind seeing my ball kind of go offline because I've had an interesting lie. What really beats you down is looking for your ball, right? Mm-hmm. Losing balls, getting stuck deep in rough and just not being able to get out, hacking out all day. That kind of difficulty really wears down on the amateur. And I don't think there is a whole lot of that at Southern Hills. You know, the rough is significant, right? You have to, it settles down in that kind of woolly rough out there.
That Bermuda, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, like, it's not easy rough by any stretch of the imagination.
But you find your ball quickly.
But you find your ball and you usually have a chance to play out because there are gaps between the trees. And so you always have a shot. Even if you really shouldn't maybe take the risk, you always feel like you have a shot at it. And that little bit of hope that the course gives you is pretty key to enjoyment, right? Because if you're just hacking out and if you're in a forest, there's no hope. There's no fun in that. And so I think that's what Southern Hills offers and why it is fun even for somebody like me.
Do you think it would be better if it wasn't a championship course? If they had no qualms on
it? That's an unsettled question to me right now. So I don't think it necessarily would be a lot better. I'm trying to imagine a counterfactual restoration that doesn't even take into account the championship status of the course. If the course were put exactly back to what it was in Maxwell's time, then there would be probably fewer trees out there. The rough would probably be maintained differently. The creek would be different, right, in appearance. But, you know, speaking of the creek, right, there are places where that creek looks pretty polished, right? Yeah. There's a kind of modern look to it. There are a few waterfalls here and there, you know, things like that. That used to be a rugged, mostly dry creek. And I think that would be cooler, right? It would be to have a Barranca restoration like they did at Los Angeles Country Club would definitely be, I don't know, would fit my eye a little bit better, would fit my preferences a little bit better, but wouldn't necessarily fit everybody's preferences. And so there are a few things out there that, you know, I kind of raised an eyebrow at, but eventually came to understand, you know, that the creek, for instance, right, there's just going to be more water in it now because there's more water in that general area.
Yeah,
now.
The development. There's
all kinds of pavement and concrete around the course that used to just be land that would absorb moisture. Now there's a lot of water that moves through that creek system. And of course, they use more water to maintain the golf course now than they did in the 1930s. And so, would I want to play the 1936 version of the course? Absolutely. I mean, that would be awesome.
I think that's with everywhere.
Yeah. I mean, what place is that not true of? And so I'm not sure it's necessarily possible to imagine a pure restoration of that golf course. That said, you know, we've both seen Gil Hance's work, Hance Golf Course Design's work at Los Angeles Country Club. And that restoration is pretty historically faithful. Obviously, there were a few changes made to accommodate the modern game. The golf course is quite a bit longer, et cetera. But that bunker restoration was more rugged. And of course, I'd referred to the Barranca before. Southern Hills has more of a polished look. And, if it weren't hosting championships, maybe there wouldn't be so much pressure to make the course look kind of Augustified. That said, it looks awesome. Like it, you know, this feels nitpicky.
Something I really thought was interesting, like if you talk to people and ask them about Southern Hills, a lot of people, we live in this culture with like Instagram and where par threes are like glorified and like the cat's meow, you know, like everybody, because it's like the only
16th hole, Sleepy Hollow,
yeah,
Pebble Beach, seventh hole.
You know. It's like the only hole you can take a picture of and you can see the whole hole, right? You know, easily and discern it easily. So like par threes, I feel like have become like the darling of like how you judge a course. And a lot of people would say that the par threes are the weakness at Southern Hills. People would say, oh, they're bland. But part of me thinks the par threes at Southern Hills all connected the other golf course. So they were the holes that kind of navigate are on edges of the property, like where Maxwell got into corners, either get him out of the corners, or, you know, we see with the 11th, which is a tremendous short par three, you know, that 10th hole navigates this like really severe land. And from where the 11th tee is, that land's almost too severe to even put a hole that wouldn't be a par three. And it's like the par threes out there are the holes which make the fives and the fours. And I think that's really the strength of Southern Hills is they have great par fives and great par fours. And those are the holes that make those holes so great because they got Maxwell to the spots he needed to be to get the par fours playing the way he wanted.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. The par threes do seem to serve a kind of connecting function. And they occupy some kind of awkward corners of the property. They're all at the edges of the property. And two of them are right at corners of the property specifically. The 11th hole is probably the most natural par three in there, as in the land seems most naturally suited to a par three, right? Par threes are good places to put holes on really severe land. Right. And that's the case at the 11th hole. You wouldn't be able to put another kind of hole on that land, I don't think, without moving a lot of it. Some of the other par threes are kind of on flattish pieces of land, I guess. The 8th hole is on this, more or less nondescript tract of land that connects the 7th hole to the 9th hole. The 14th hole, the par three, runs along the boundary of the property. It goes downhill a little bit, but again, you know, if you were walking this land before the golf course was built, you wouldn't necessarily go to that piece of the property and say, oh, that's obviously a par three. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
I think you put the rest of the routing together and then you realize that you have space for a par three in a certain place. And that is, yeah, I mean, I think in order to make the routing work the way he wanted to, and in order to have some of those great longer holes, in order to get the greens returning to that gully that runs through the center of the property, there's a collection of really interesting contours that runs through the center of the property, and he put a bunch of greens and tees on there
and fairways.
And fairways, yeah,
like
fairways
landing areas. Yeah, that's what I thought. 13 I was thinking
and
about.
16.
It's interesting because like that's what you see. It's this narrow property, and the way he used the interesting topography in different ways, and like the way he was able to it seemed like it was a pretty abrupt shelf that would go like there was like this almost like you have the creek where the creek is in a flat, but then there was a shelf, and how many ways he used that shelf in landing areas is really amazing.
I agree. Yeah.
You know, like the 17th uses it, the 18th uses it, the 10th uses it, the 12th uses it by the green, but then like the 13th and 16th use that shell, like it's right in the middle of the drive landing area. And it makes for just really odd lies, like, you know, like you're having like on a par five having to hit into a green from an upslope to, you know, you've got 230 and you're hitting from an upslope into a green with water short of it. That's a really uncomfortable shot to hit. Yes.
Yeah.
Or as a downslope long, furthermore.
On 16. Yeah. The long par four, you have the same situation where the landing area. And it's not just that it's a straight gully, right? Obviously, there used to be water that ran through there and that carved the land. But what happened as the water moved through there over the centuries is that it created not just a straight water course, but all of these super interesting contours, these billowing landforms around itself, right?
Yeah.
And so that's what you get on those two landing areas that you're talking about. It's not just a straight scoop. It is these, you know, wavy undulations suddenly in the middle of what's generally a pretty smooth piece of land. It's a sloping piece of land, but the contours are generally long. When you get to that part of the property that we're talking about, where there used to be that water course, it becomes, there's a lot more micro contour. You see those going into the 17th hole as well, right? Where again, there are these wavy contours that have been carved by water over time. And it's, he used that over and over and over again. And to return to the point earlier, I think that in order to use it in the way he did on those long holes, he couldn't have par threes in the middle of the property. He needed to have those longer holes in the middle of the property, and the par threes needed to be pushed to the edges.
Yeah. As we've talked about this, I've started to like think about, it's like Prairie Dunes has that wavy, that contour where it's really unpredictable. You could have the ball could be below your feet or above your feet depending on what side. It has that unpredictable nature that you see in the areas where the water used to run through at Southern Hills, what you were just alluding to. And then Augusta National has that, just like that general, like it you know, the land moves one way, right? And it's just this big, broad slope that the holes are carved around. And Southern Hills is kind of like a mixture of the two between Augusta and Prairie Dunes, where there are these pockets of really, you know, flowy micro contours that, you know, have, you don't know what, when you hit the ball in there, you have no clue whether you're going to have, be on an upslope, a downslope, which side slope you'll have. And that's like Prairie Dunes. But then for the most part, the property is more like Augusta National with these big broad slopes that leave you with these severe sloping lies.
You really see the big broad slopes on that sequence of holes that goes out to the par three 11th, right? The 10th, 11th, and then the returning 12th hole, where you can just clearly see when you're standing below it that was a lovely river valley. Right? Just beautiful sweep of land. And he just laid out three lovely golf holes on it. But those are broad, smooth slopes. In other parts of the property, it's crazier. And it's amazing how many different ways he used those fun landforms in the middle of the property.
Yeah.
You just go back to it a lot.
It's like the exterior of the property has the big broad slopes, and then the interior had the randomness, because like you think about the par five fifth has that slope from left to right, you know, and you're hitting into a green that, you know, with a creek right, and then seven is the same way, you know, with it hard left to right, and that's on an edge of the property. It's really interesting to think about in terms of how that property laid out. It's a stunning property. I'm that place. I was not expecting to be as enamored as I was with Southern Hills when we decided to go there.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's a great golf course. It's a stunning golf course. And, I think that, I hope that now that it's opened up a little bit, that there's more short grass that you can see across the golf course better, see multiple holes at once, that it'll become more apparent.
I think the bunker, the aesthetics of the bunkers are going to make a huge difference for the television product too. Mm-hmm. As much as, like, you know, I hate that, but, like, you know, like the old bunkers just looked like bunkers you'd see at your $15 Muni, you know, like perfectly circular. Saucers. Yeah. Saucers. Yeah. And like,
yeah,
now
they have these raised lips and
And now they have at least a little bit of character. To me, that's what the work done is. It kind of brought to life so much of the greatness of the property and the character of the golf course.
Right. And before, with those saucer shapes and the way that they were all kind of tilted up toward the line of play, your eye immediately went to them, right? That's all you saw, is this really white sand in these scoops out of the course. And they drew the eye, and because they were fairly bland in their shape, that was just your impression of the course, right? These little scoops. Part of the restoration was bringing down the edges of the bunkers a little bit. There had been a lot of buildup over the years. And so the edges of the bunkers, the lips of the bunkers, I should say, are not as high. And so as a result, they're not the highest points on holes. Now often the greens are the highest points on holes. And I think that makes a big visual difference, because instead of just fixating on these circular or oval bunker shapes with the white sand in them and having that be your impression of the golf course, your eye can be drawn to a number of different features. The bunkers, the green edges, you know, there are other things that attract your attention.
The creek. Yeah, the creek. Yeah. You know, which
creek has been exposed a lot more, and the creek has been extended across a couple of holes, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't running across the 17th hole before. It wasn't running across the 10th hole before. Now, you know, that creek has an influence on play on those holes.
Yeah, up the right side of the fourth fairway too. Yes. So it, just to give a little bit more thought off the tee on those holes. I think the 17th hole is one of my, that green's really, really nasty, and it's just got that great land where you're just banking left or right. You like want to get it up way up left. That's what probably, to me, maybe the most compelling hole out there is the 17th. And it's cool to have that short par four coming down the stretch of a major right before just a ball buster of a par four up the hill.
That'll be fun to watch, the 17th. Yeah, it's a short par four. And if they put tees in a certain place, players will be able to drive it up by the green a little bit. But they'll be probably aiming left of the green. And if you're left of the green up there, that's a really, 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 really hard shot. Yeah. You know, you might not hit the green from 15 feet away from it over there. But equally, if you're on the wrong little micro contour in that fairway and you have a nasty lie with the ball below your feet and you're a right-hander and you're trying to hit a feely little pitch into that green off of the fairway grass, that's an incredibly intimidating shot too. And the green is kind of oriented, diagonally away from you, kind of like a 10 o'clock facing green with a bunker in front of it. I mean, it repels off on all the edges. It's just, I had a mental breakdown in that fairway. Like I couldn't hit the ball cleanly on my pitch. And it's just intimidating.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a cool hole. I'm excited. I always enjoy going and seeing courses based, like going on trips where you see a lot of one architect, and I'm really excited to go see more Maxwell. Like it's like Oklahoma is like actually like on my travel radar for like, I need to go see six courses there, you know?
Yeah,
all Maxwell. Like, and that's the unique thing, is like starting to understand this guy more. You see him at Augusta, you see him at, you know, the Crystal Downs has a heavy Maxwell influence, but then, you know, Prairie Dunes and Southern Hills are both really good representations of his work. How would you split 10 rounds between those two courses? I'm putting you in the uncomfortable
spot. That's a tough question, because My impulse would be to say 6 or 7 prairie dunes and 3 or 4 southern hills. And that's no slam on southern hills, because prairie dunes is just, I mean, it's unbelievably sublime out there, and just a completely unique place. But here's the thing, because the mowing lines are currently what they are at Prairie Dunes, and we touched on this a little bit, but you know, there are some places where there seems to be some fairway expansion in order, and the gunch is really, really hard to play out of. I do think that playing a lot of rounds at Prairie Dunes does tire you out a little bit, or tire me out a little bit, because you have to
drive the ball so well.
Yeah, you have to be really precise off the tee, and if you're not, it becomes a very, very long round there. And that's it's kind of a weird complaint to lodge, because it's such a unbelievable golf course. But I think if you're playing a lot of rounds someplace, that you don't want to be losing a ton of golf balls, right? And that it would kind of beat you down after a while. So I'd say in their current form, Southern Hills and Prairie Dunes, I know this sounds like a cop out, I think I'd split the rounds evenly. It's an enjoyable round of golf at Southern Hills, and that course is closer to maximizing its potential, I think, that Prairie Dunes is right now.
Yeah. That's like the thing that, hey, I'm a dreamer, so I always think about this stuff, and what courses could be. And I think Prairie Dunes could be so insanely good, where you talk about it with like the biggest names in golf.
Top five, right?
Yeah. You could rattle the best courses in the country, and Prairie Dunes is like belonging of like if it maximized what it could be with the fair. And the thing about Prairie Dunes is like it's the easiest work, it's the lowest hanging fruit. Like you just have to go out there and like be like, okay, we just have to mow this, you know.
The lines are kind of there, right? You know, like if you look at the 17th hole right now, Prairie Dunes, unbelievable golf hole. If you just mow the fairway out to the gunch, then all of a sudden you have basically what you need.
Yeah, and it wouldn't make the golf course any easier.
Oh, absolutely not.
Like that's the thing, is like it would just make it way more interesting. You'd probably see more people hitting it in the gunch because they knew they could hit it over to a certain side, and it would just create so many more options. I hate saying options, but like the holes would become so much more compelling. And there are extraordinarily compelling holes. Like I drive the ball usually really well, so I would probably play like six or seven rounds, 4 or 3. And I love Southern Hills. I just that Prairie Dunes is just a place that's, I think, with the way the course changes and how it plays, and you didn't get to see it in a different wind. Like the trip I made the time before, we had a warm couple of days, and then we had the north wind come, and it was just a completely different golf course. So the weather aspect of Prairie Dunes is amazing, because the golf course gets variety day to day just by the way the wind's playing. It's a completely different golf course. The 7th hole is this par 5 that when it's warm, it plays dead downwind, and it's like, you know, if you hit it long, it's like a driver like short iron into this par 5. But then when the wind flips around, all of a sudden it's like, that's a 3-shot hole, and it's very, very hard. The drive is terrifying. The layup's terrifying. And that's a hole that could use a lot of width on the layup, because like most days, no good player is ever laying up, and the layup there is one of the hardest shots on the golf course. And it's reserved for, you know, the 10 plus handicaps.
Yeah, no, it's a good point that, day-to-day variety at Prairie Dunes would be tough to beat. That golf course is so good. It is on a different level than Southern Hills, just because of the land, really. And we should also mention that the club at Prairie Dunes is a lot of fun and pretty distinctive, because it's not, you know, Southern Hills is a great club as well, but you use the word grand. It has a grand clubhouse, and it is a grand membership. Prairie Dunes is very different, right? It's a lot more unassuming, and it is just kind of the local Hutchinson club. While we were there, it was very hot, and the local kids were all gathered around the pool.
Yeah.
Right? They were all there just playing. This was their country club. This is just where they go. This is where the activity is. Oh yeah, there happens to be a world-class golf course here too. And I really liked that feel of the club. I liked the fact that it was woven into the local community, and that the dues for the members there, the local members there, are affordable enough so that people can belong to it.
I think it's a difference also. Just like, you know, if Prairie Dunes was in Tulsa,
it would be
just the way Southern Hills is. Like Southern Hills is the big club for the city, you know. And anytime you go into any city, you know, Southern Hills is similar to your, you know, your ritzy club at any city, and Prairie Dunes is like a small town club. And it's got a charm, and it's got character that very few great golf courses have, because most great golf courses, like we talked about at the outset, are located in big cities, and those great golf courses become, you know, have a similar feel to them across them, where it's, you know, and that's where Prairie Dunes is so unique. That's a good, great point.
Yeah, no, it was a fun place to be. And you know, if you have 10 rounds and you get to spend them at Prairie Dunes and Southern Hills, you can't really go wrong no matter what you do.
What if we threw Cottonwood in there, the Nick Faldo course down the street?
Oh, no. I was wondering whether you would bring it up. Yeah, there's a Nick Faldo course near Prairie Dunes in really, really, really great land, like sort of Prairie Dunes style land. And you know, Nick Faldo was out there on a bulldozer, obviously. And well, probably not. But in any case, we drove in there and took a look around, and
Cottonwood National.
Yeah, Cottonwood National, yeah.
Yeah.
There was some containment mounding going on. There were the unbelievable natural dunes, and then also containment mounding.
Yeah. Yeah, this we'll probably do more of these. We'll just talk about golf courses. Let us know what you think about it. This is you know, Garrett will be back on pretty regularly, and so that was our trip to Maxwell Land. I'm eager to get back. Maybe to new Maxwell Land later this year.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of places to go, but
one of the great things about Maxwell is tons of places are public.
Yeah,
tons of public Maxwells.
If you go deep in a certain region, if you go deep in Oklahoma
or North Carolina,
you'll find places to play for sure.
Yeah. So, all right, we'll reconvene, and good talking to you.
All right. Thanks, Andy.